Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. When President Trump took office in January 2017, one of his first actions was to ban travel to the United States for people from seven Muslim-majority nations. One of those countries was Somalia. The East African nation has been without a stable government for most of the last three decades. Its capital, Mogadishu, has been called the most dangerous city on earth. For Somalians, escaping the country for a better life elsewhere was always hard. President Trump's travel ban made it even more so. One of those who did make it out of Somalia and to America is a young man named Abdi Noor Iftin. He's in his early 30s and grew up in Mogadishu. You may have heard him on This American Life, which chronicled his path to America through the Diversity Lottery Program, which is now in danger of being eliminated. Abdi's new memoir is titled Call Me American, and he's here in the studio with us now. Abdi, welcome to the program. And we're going to talk this hour about Abdi's journey to America. We're also going to talk about immigration and learn about what the immigration system looks like from the perspective of someone who has navigated his way through it. What questions do you have for Abdi? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Abdi, I've got a copy of your book here, Call Me American. It kept me up past midnight on Saturday night. It was amazing. What an incredible story. Thank you very much for putting in such tremendous effort to tell it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be able to put my story into a book for people to see what we have been through and the stories that we have.
Yeah, it's really incredible. So maybe we should start where it all started with you. Tell us about growing up in Somalia. There was a big shift in 1991 when the government that was in power there fell. But tell us about your early life in Somalia before that happened. What was it like?
It's hard to remember the good days, except what, you know, talking to my mother and all of those days. But I remember that my dad was building a beautiful life when he came to the city from the nomadic life. And Mogadishu at the time was one of the growing cities in Africa, and so with some sheer luck, he ended up playing basketball, which was a really good thing because he didn't go to the army, which would be a bad thing. At the time, Somalia was at war with Ethiopia, and the army were, you know, deployed to the borders. But Dad had had the opportunity to build a really, really good life by, you know, traveling abroad and bringing some jewelry and medals from playing basketball internationally. And we were born in, you know, my brother and I and my sister were born in this kind of middle class family, you know, where we could afford food and we had a place to stay. And somehow, to me, around that age, 5-4, it was, I would only cry when I couldn't find, you know, the snacks that I liked, or when my brother would take things away from me. I never thought of I would be that things would be miserable, that we would never be able to find a place to live and something to eat. So the journey ahead, you know, after those days was just incredible and unforgettable. So I have survived through it, and that's why I was able to just tell the story, to tell the world that you know, sometimes you're not supposed to die. You're supposed to leave so that you can be able to tell the story to the rest of the world. So somehow I think it was meant to be the way it was meant to be. I talk about in the book how, you know, when the Civil War erupted, how things had been completely destroyed It had a feeling of an entire building that collapses, you know, to the floor, and
quite literally, but also figuratively.
Yes, both of them. And it is, you know, it's a moment where I prayed, you know, that we die. I thought that, you know, death was better than anything else. And it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But we were supposed to leave, like I said. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's been really miserable. It's been...
Well, describe the extent of the misery. I mean, what was life like after the government fell? I mean, we see in popular culture images of a destroyed city. That's essentially where you were living for most of your life in Mogadishu. It was a city that couldn't quite function, and there were shootings and there were explosions. What was it like for you throughout your early childhood and early teen years to have to live in a situation like that?
Well, I would say at first it was kind of hard to accept it, to, you know, live through it, but we got adjusted. It became something regular. It became our day-to-day life, and at some point it becomes something fun, where I would find myself following the militias with AK-47 and with, you know, these are militias, the same militias that destroyed the city.
Mm-hmm. And you're holding an AK-47. How old were you?
I was not holding AK-47.
Oh, you weren't
holding it? Yeah, I was following around the militias themselves. I was actually too small at the time and too weak, of course, because mm-hmm. we've been thinking. It was not only the war that had been killing the people at the time, it was also the famine that, you know, erupted and had been killing everyone else. So, and my sister, our youngest sister was killed by the famine. She came out starving already and thin, and you know, we lost her that way. So yeah, it just became something fun. I didn't carry a gun, but we carried something that looked like a gun to make it fun, you know, like mm-hmm. sticks and stuff like that, and we would shoot at each other making sounds through our mouths. And so somehow the action, it's like an action film that was happening before our eyes, you know, when the militias fight each other, we would just dodge and hide and come up and laugh and run and, you know, continue doing our own stuff. It was not like the developed world where one thing happens and then they bring the yellow tape, you know, the police arrives and the whole place is and all goes on. But the Mogadishu was completely the opposite. When something happens, we would storm into that and see the faces of the dead, and we would see who was killed and who sometimes the faces were familiar, and I would say, like, you know, and I talk about it in my book, they all had nicknames, like long-eared, you know, big mouth and stuff like that, and we would say, like, oh, that's long-eared, he's dead, you know, he was shot, and then we continue from there. So it actually, interestingly enough, just becomes something we got adjusted to. And this is a city at the time that before the United States and the international community intervened, this was a city that was completely destroyed. There was no functioning institution at all. There was no hospital, no school. So it was, you know, it was a city of women and children. Men were the ones that were being targeted. So unless you're carrying a gun, you can't be living in the city. You can't be like a regular father who takes care of his kids. It was so hard. And that's one of the reasons that we couldn't find our dad. Mm-hmm. And so we assumed he was dead, because there was the chances of man being killed was so high that I told all my friends, you know, we lost our dad. So in this case, we were all the orphans, mm-hmm. My brother and I and my sister. And mom never expected that we would ever be able to find that, you know, back into our lives. So this is the extent of the chaos and crisis that was actually at the time happening in this city. So what did it feel like? It actually felt like, for those who have been in Mogadishu, it's very hot. You know, it's so hard to walk on the streets barefoot during the day. and we couldn't afford shoes or flip-flops. So we could make our own stuff. Like, I would put together some sticks and try to step on them and try to walk around that way. So it felt like hell. You know, hell was everywhere. I could look up in the sky, and the sky was blue. And at night, the stars were shining at us. Like, they couldn't, you know, the wars that was happening in Mogadishu could never reach there. So they were just right there and happy. And at some point, I thought, like, I wish I could be there, you know, away from here.
Well, can I ask you what you, at that time, imagined your future would look like?
Oh, I never imagined that I would leave. So there was no future to think about, honestly. So they, unless, you know, it's like we were caught up in this situation where you can die anytime. So what happens at this point is you have to do the right thing. So, like, if you die, you don't have to go to hell. So what happened was my mother was encouraging me to go to madrasa school.
This was the school where they taught you how to memorize and understand the Quran?
How to memorize and understand the Quran. And the main reason is for us to succeed either on earth or, you know, afterlife. So, like, if I lived through the war, I would spread the word orally, you know, teach other kids to learn the Quran. That's the future that my mom was looking at the time. And if I died, it would be a great thing because, you know, while memorizing the Quran, if you die that way, you know, it's a promise that you can go to heaven or paradise. So that is what the Mogadishians at the time were thinking about. There was no future of, like, becoming a biologist or a journalist or an engineer or a doctor. Those things never came even close to my mind. You know, it's not something that I ever thought of. The movies that I had seen just cracked open a wonderful window of uncertain future in my life.
We should clarify that these are American movies, these bootleg Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone or Bruce Willis movies that made its way to a makeshift movie theater. And this, correct me if I'm wrong, was your first introduction to American culture.
It was. That's true. It was. And it was a perfect introduction, I would say, because if you have seen The Terminator or The Commandos or The Rambos, it's an action film. It involves shootings and, you know, people doing some things. But somehow it looked similar to what was happening in Mogadishu, but it also looked different. It looked similar because it involved people shooting other people. But if, you know, there's some life that you can see through movies. You know, like, you can see streets, you can see malls, you can see people having breakfast, you can see the cops, you can see other lives that you can never imagine in Mogadishu. And to me, that was an introduction to America. You know, it's like, well, you know what? These people look really wonderful. And the way they fight, the way they, you know, they do things, it's just absolutely amazing. I kind of love it. So somehow, at first time, I was attracted to the big, muscly people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ramp and Sylvester Stallone. And I said, well, let me see this. And I saw it. It was not only me. It was a crowd of younger, you know, children or teenagers at the time that stormed into the movies. And we were, you know, it was, honestly, it was the only entertainment that you can find in Mogadishu. What else can you find? There's nothing else to do. We don't know baseball or tennis or anything else. You can't do that. So this lady had, you know, was able to just give us some sort of entertainment for us to get our minds away from what was happening in Mogadishu into the world of action movies and English. And at some point, most of us were so attracted to action movies. But then I was like, there's a lot of conversation happening before any action happens. Not
in the film, there's a lot of English conversation happening.
A lot of English conversation happening. A lot of swear words, you know. And I thought that all Americans swear. So when I came here, I just realized that everyone doesn't do that. But yeah, I told her, I said, can you know, turn up the volume? I really want to listen to this.
To
the words. Yeah. And she laughed at me. She said, why would you care to even, you know, want to hear what they're talking about. So at the time, did I know that I would learn English? I did not. But something, you know, triggered me because I was memorizing Quran. I was really very good at memorizing things. I was really very good at picking up things easily. And I was going to the madrasa and learning the Quran very fast and everything else. And I thought, you know, it doesn't matter if I eat for 3 days or 4 days, but I have a mind that's prepared, that's ready to see things, to learn things. And at some point, it didn't even take me that long to actually be able to say, I'll be back, you know, and try to practice with everyone else in the city, including my mother. And she would always yell at me and say, like, stop, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Listeners, we're speaking with Abdi Noor Iftin. He's from Somalia, and he now lives in Maine, where he works as an interpreter. And we're speaking this hour about his journey to America through the Diversity Lottery Program, as chronicled in his new memoir, which is called Call Me American. What questions do you have for Abdi? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So you learned English by watching all these films. You eventually became sort of the resident translator at this movie house, where people would turn to you and say, what are they saying? And you would give a translation. When did you realize that you wanted to come to America?
I realized when I was, I think, 8 years old, when the U.S. Marines left Mogadishu. They intervened humanitarianly because of the droughts. The United States newspapers had published pictures of young, you know, children like my age at the time, who's, you know, they were so thin and malnourished, and you know, bags and insects, you know, landing on their faces. So somehow, the United States Marines, you know, decided to intervene and provide some food. So that's an interesting question. So when the U.S. uniforms were all over Mogadishu before the Black Hawk Down happened, they were collecting arms and weapons from houses. And at one point, you know, they could come to our house, you know, the place where we were staying at the time, in their Humvees, and they laugh and smile and look into my eyes and say something that I couldn't understand. And then they had, I think, an M16 gun, and that was not pointed to my face. It was pointed away from me all the time, just making sure that, you know, they don't have to accidentally shoot at us. So to us, that was extremely strange. It's like, mm-hmm. We lived with the Somali militias, and the way they harassed us or threatened, or the way they had been making us fear them, scared of them, was to point the gun. You know, I could. It's like you have to see the gun barrel in you, through your eyes. Like you can see the hole where the bullet comes out. That's the life I have experienced. But the U.S. weren't doing that. They were just providing us with some snacks, sweets, and candies, and stuff like that, and chocolate. And then they would not point the guns at our, you know, on our faces. But at some point, they just leave. And there was lots of food distribution centers that were open all over the place at the time. When they left, though, and completely, you know, withdraw from Mogadishu, that's when I realized I really want to be there where these people are. That was an initial, you know, of me, like, telling my friends, I was still so little, telling my friends, like, they left me behind. They were not supposed to do that. It was incredible. Yeah, we follow them, and they would go into the ocean because they're somehow, you know, it was an alien kind of life, honestly, where, like, they could disappear into the ocean and get away from us, you know. And I said, that's where I need to be, somewhere beyond this ocean. That's where they are. You know, that's where I need to be. That's when I need to join them. So that's the initial me, you know, Jail Abdi, thinking, I wanna go join. But then, as I grew up, as years passed, as my English had improved a lot, I had learned so much about America, that America is not only a white country, it's also a multicultural, that there's Eddie Murphy, that there's Denzel Washington, who are also Americans and live in America. And then I got introduced to Michael Jackson, you know, Snoop Dogg, and, you know, Tupac, and all these rappers that you can imagine that got me to see another America. You know, it's like, wow, you don't have to be white to actually live in this place. You can be, of, you know, the same color as you are. And I was not quite, you know, familiar with racism or how this whole color thing works. To me, Denzel Washington was just like myself. I couldn't understand why he didn't speak Somali. Mm-hmm. But I thought that that's it. That's where I need to be, you know, the peaceful place where they only do action movies to shoot at each other. But then in real life, I realized that it's a stable country. It's a beautiful, wonderful country. So, and, you know, and I would say as years passed, I had tremendously increased my passion and love and appreciation for the U.S. democracy, freedom, and the opportunities that the United States provides. So I had been more open to, like, figure out and do a lot of research on how America was and stuff like that. That's how I got to know so many presidents.
Well, as the years increased and as your love for America increased, it got increasingly dangerous in Somalia, driving the need for you to get out and get out in a hurry. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Abdi, we'll talk about your involvement with the Divisa Lottery Program and how it eventually led to your coming here. And listeners, we want to invite you to the conversation as well. We'll get into the nitty-gritty on this particular program, which is actually on the chopping block, according to some pieces of legislation. What questions do you have about how it works? You can ask Abdi by calling 1-800-892-6477. Or email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back.
Hello?
NHPR Summer Car Raffle is back.
Oh my gosh, are you for real?
You could drive away with $2,000 in gas cards to use at any gas station, or you could win the grand prize, $25,000 toward a new car.
No, I've never won anything before. That's terrific. I'm going to hyperventilate now.
But you can't win if you don't play. Get your raffle tickets now, just $50 each, or six for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with Abdi Noor Iftin, the author of the new memoir, Call Me American. He's telling us about his life in Somalia and his journey to the United States. In fact, we're going to focus on that part in this part of the program, his journey to the United States, how he got here through the Diversity Lottery Program, also known as the Green Card Lottery. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Abdi, you got here through the Diversity Lottery Program. How did you first learn about this program?
So I, you know, when I came to Kenya, I had an access to internet, and also I was able to rent a lot of DVDs, Hollywood movies. So at this point, I was able to do enough research on ways to get to the United States. But before the lottery, I tried everything. Refugee process takes as long as 20 and above. So at this point, I was hopeless in that case because it's like a lottery itself. You can get picked or never. So they told me 20 years, and I said, well, okay, you know, well, so let's move on and try something else.
Find something else, yeah.
But I had a very powerful American friends, including doctors and engineers and these great people that heard my story, and they were involved in my life. They had been supporting me in so many ways.
Yeah.
So we tried student visa. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get it. But so when I was denied a student visa, and the officer was very honest about it, and he said, you know what? You are homeless or stateless because you can never go back to Somalia. And in Kenya, you will be a refugee for the rest of your life. So if you end up going to the United States on a student visa, it actually means a non-immigrant visa, which actually also means that you need to come back mm-hmm. once you're done with your studies. So the officer said, I'm so certain that you're not coming back. So in this case, you'll seek asylum. I said, that's right. So he said, I deny your visa because of that.
Yeah.
It's bureaucracy. And I didn't give up, though. So what did I do? We did research. And I knew that the diversity lottery was something that some people had used to come to the United States, but Somalis were not wake enough. I mean, we didn't know it. We had no, like, because we're refugees and we were not sure if this is something that was applicable to the Somalis. Mm-hmm. But one evening in October, when my friends and I were having tea, I saw the notice on the wall at the cyber cafe. Well, and when I got so close to this notice, it says, apply for the U.S. Green Card Lottery, and it doesn't cost anything. Just 5 minutes, you put in, you know, you take a picture of yourself and you put in information, that's it. So it was as simple as that. And it did not cost me 20 cents or so. You know, it was completely like nothing. So why wouldn't I try? But did I know that I would win? I was not. I was not real. I thought that somehow the Americans would figure it out that this is a Somali guy, refugee, applying to this, so I would be disqualified. That was my initial thinking. But because there was no other way open to immigrate to the United States at that point. Mm-hmm. So it was desperate. And I forced my friends to try. And we were like almost more than 10 people. And I said,
so you all tried?
We all tried.
Yeah.
And we said, let's see who wins.
Yeah. Just to provide a little bit of context for listeners who may not be familiar with this. So the Diversity Lottery Program essentially is for potential immigrants from underrepresented countries in the United States. So I don't believe people from Mexico, for example, would qualify for this, but people from Somalia would. And what you see when you go online, I'm not sure how it was when you applied, Abdi, but right now it's just a form online. You can enter your name and your address and your country of citizenship, and then it tells you if you are eligible. Something like more than 9 million people applied in 2015. And then 155,000 people were chosen mm-hmm. to be further screened in the year that you applied, Abdi. And then ultimately 55,000 people are admitted. So 55,000 people out of more than 9 million who apply, those are incredible odds to beat. Incredible.
Incredible. I agree with you. Specifically, look at, if you were a Mexican or Nigerian or Kenyan, it would be easy because there's only two requirements. If you have to either graduate from a high school that the United States recognizes, like a high school in Mexico would be recognizable, mm-hmm. or you had, if you worked with an agency that is... that the world knows, or like if you worked with the United Nations, something like that. So those two requirements would qualify someone to go ahead and apply for their visa. But what happened to me? I didn't have a high school diploma because any document from Somalia is unacceptable, and apparently because there's none since the government collapsed. So right. I didn't go to any basic school in Somalia. So at this point, my brother looked at me in the eyes one night when the bombing happened in Kenya and we were stuck in the building. He said, Abdi, I don't think you're going to make it. It's hard because you can't get the documents. And also, you don't have either of the requirements. How are you supposed to do this? It was the only moment in the entire world that I had seen my brother who encouraged me in the most difficult days of our lives. But this day, he said, I said this, and I don't think it's going to work it because if you look at it, it's so hard. So as a Somali, as a Muslim, as a United States kind of considered Somalia as Islamic state at that moment, you know, in those days. The chances were really, really very low that I could ever be able to be accepted to get a visa to move to the United States. But I didn't have anything to lose. I fought for it. Mm-hmm. I kept going.
And how did you feel when you finally got the notification that you were selected for I think it was, quote unquote, further processing?
Yeah, it says further processing. That's a key word. That's a key word. And I wasn't
still a big deal, but not quite over the finish line yet.
It was not. Yeah, even though my friends threw me around and I wasn't quite. I was like, am I going to the U.S. tomorrow? Because I haven't done enough research on like what happens when you get selected. And then when we figured out that it's a long process again, it depends on because when you are selected, they like you said 125,000 people. That's, you know, the number average number that they select, and then they only give 55,000 visas. So some of those people are disqualified based on the number that they are given. So the numbers are either high or low. So I had a high number.
It was like 47,000.
Yes,
and change.
It's really considered as, you know, in Africa, the 47,000 number is high. And at some point, I did research, and that was also another disappointment to me. But I had one good chance, which was, it depends on what country you're coming from. Somalia, many people hadn't applied, but each country has a 7% number of applicants. So if those 7% are all, you know, all do their interviews and everything else, the others might be disqualified. So at this point, I was probably the only Somali, or maybe there were others, I haven't heard of them, but I was the only Somali who was all over the place, you know, trying to do this. So I had that good chance, whereas like in terms of a country, I have the chance of moving forward. But in terms of everything else, the chances were really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, please do ask Abdi your questions if you have them about his journey, about how the immigration system looks from his perspective. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So part of the process for getting one of these visas in the green card lottery is that you have to go through an interview. And this was well chronicled on This American Life, and I believe the program was reissued this week, talking about how you felt leading up to that July 22nd interview. Mm-hmm. But really quickly, Abdi, tell us what you had to do to get ready for that interview.
I called the embassy when I couldn't leave the apartment because of the police, the Kenyan police, round up on the Somalis. We were either being sent to this place we called the concentration camp. It was like a soccer field. But then they had been taking all the Somali refugees either back to Somalia or to this concentration camp. And the two choices were horrible. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that. So
can I slow you down for just a second? So you were living in a place called Little Mogadishu, right? Which is in a part of Nairobi, was it?
Uh-huh. It's in the eastern part of Nairobi, yeah.
And that's where Somali immigrants like yourself were living, hoping to find either shelter from the problems in Somalia or, frankly, shelter from the problems in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so your choices were go to that concentration camp, that makeshift prison that was a soccer field, mm-hmm. or join the military, was it?
No, back to Somalia.
Back to Somalia.
They would send us back to Somalia, which was a really, really bad choice, because if I went back to Somalia, I would be easily recruited into either the Islamists or the government, which mm-hmm. both wasn't really good. So what did I do? I called the embassy, United States Embassy, and I said, I remember I had tears on my eyes, and I said, this is the golden opportunity in my entire life. You know, I got selected, but can I, you know, is there anything that I can do not to go for the, what they call the good conduct letter? So the good conduct letter is one of the requirements. It doesn't matter where, even if you're in Canada, if you win the U.S. lottery, you have to go to the Canadian police to make sure that you are not a criminal in Kenya. If you had done any crimes in Canada, you wouldn't move to the United States. So it was the same in Kenya at the time.
You had to go to the Kenyan police.
I had to go to the Kenyan police. So what does this mean? It's like going into the crocodile's jaws, you know, because they were looking for us. They were all over the place. And my brother and I were into hiding into our apartment. We ignored when they knocked at our, you know, at our door. So it was the toughest choice in my entire life to, like, walk away on the streets of Mogadishu, and I'm wanted, because any Somali was at the time yelled at, and, you know, the regular Kenyans would kill you because they would assume that we're all Al-Shabaab, we're all mm-hmm. radical Islamists. And they were so, it all started when five or six Somali Al-Shabaab or Somali radical Islamists attacked a mall in Nairobi and killed almost 70 people.
People may remember the Westgate Mall.
The Westgate Mall, that's mm-hmm. what it was called. And it took days for the Kenyans to clear that out. So the population in Kenya were so mad at the refugees. They were like, you're here and we let you into our country and now you're doing this. What's happening at the time was, why did Al-Shabaab do this? They did it so that the Kenyans could send us back to Somalia, because, you know, to them it was like, let's do this, and once the refugees come back to Somalia, let's take advantage. Hmm. Either kill them or recruit them. And that's how they thrive. They thrive in this chaos and craziness and wars. So so the Kenyan police were doing anything that they want to do. The U.S. hasn't said anything. It was not on CNN. You couldn't watch, listen to on the radios. So we had these stories to ourselves. And this is something that I came to Kenya to survive or escape from war. But then I found myself in the limbo. And it was a bad time, specifically when I had to go to my U.S. interview. So anyways, I needed to get that document from the Kenyan police. And the U.S. embassy said, if you don't get that, we're not going to approve your visa. Mm-hmm. So you have to get that. So what happened is, one way or another, and this is documented on This American Life, I go get it after a tough time. And then I go for my interview. And, you know, the officer says, you know what? Because we were going to college before Al-Shabaab attacked Kenya. And they say, we need a signature on the school letter that I had received by email from my school.
You needed three things at the interview, right? You needed that letter from the police department, which was hard for you to get. You went multiple times. Eventually, it took some bribes, but you made it. And then you needed a clean bill of health, right?
Yep.
And then this final thing that you're talking about is a college transcript, which they're telling you at the very last minute, doesn't have a signature. Mm-hmm. So we can't help you. But you managed to, maybe I should let you tell it. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I tell them, I'm like, it's hard for me to go to the college school. I haven't gone to school for weeks now because of the bombing and the Somalis being not able to go anywhere.
The school was literally bombed, right?
The school was not bombed.
Oh.
They bombed the Westgate Mall and also buses on the street.
The buses, yeah.
So Nairobi was turning into like Mogadishu. You could hear a bomb, you could hear gunshots and everything else, but the school was not bombed. But the way to go to the school, there were several checkpoints where the police were only specifically looking for Somalis. They could, you know, remove us from the buses and either ask us for money or would handcuff us, and which happened to me many times. And so I told the officer, I said, you know what? I really can't go to the school to get this thing signed. It's hard for me because I'm putting myself at risk by doing that. By riding the bus, I can, you know, disappear forever. And they said, you know, there's nothing we can do, so you have to do that. And I did it. I went to school. I got a transcript. And they told me, no, don't come back to the embassy. Send it through through a mailing system, DHL, which I actually did. And I haven't heard from them ever since. You know, weeks passed and I called, there was nothing. So it was extremely disappointing for me up until that Friday when I really realized that my visa had been finally approved.
And when that moment came, what was it like for you?
Oh man, I was doing a radio documentary with the British Broadcast Corporation, the BBC at the time, and they were just wondering if I would ever be able to receive my visa. So at some point, we still don't have an answer to this though, but the BBC called the United States Embassy this Friday in the morning, and they said, we're sending our reporter to Nairobi, you know, so that he could finish this documentary with Abdi. But we were not sure if Abdi would ever be able to receive his visa. So what's up? Like, is he going to, you know, get this or not? And then they said, oh, we haven't received his signed transcript so far. And my friend Leo, who was the BBC producer, called me and he said, oh, I just called the embassy and they say they still haven't received your visa. So it was Friday in Kenya, but Fridays are normally a Islamic holiday. Like, we go to the mosque and spend so much time interacting with each other and stuff like that. We couldn't do it. So I was stuck in the apartment. And then I received an email around 1 o'clock from the U.S. Embassy, which says, we have received your signed transcript and we will approve your visa and you can go and collect your visa next week, because it was Friday, and then so the weekend, and then on Monday my visa would be available on DHL. That was the best email I have ever received in my inbox. I still look at it sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, it's just incredible. You know, it got me jump up and down and hit my head in the ceilings, and I was destroying everything in it, you know, in that apartment. It's funny, isn't it? Because I was in lockdown at the time, where like the police was everywhere, and then I was the happiest man in that, you know, in that moment.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or a comment or a story to share. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Carla in Manchester. Carla, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, so much for having me.
So what's your question or comment?
Well, I also am a green card winner. I came from South Africa in the mid-90s. My experience was opposite, I guess, to your guests, in the sense that I left at a time when things were actually getting better in South Africa. Nelson Mandela had been had the first free elections. But, you know, his story just reminded me of those crazy times and all the paperwork and that green card interview, which is so similar to the movie Green Card back from that time. And in fact, they put me and my husband in separate rooms and asked really funny questions like, what kind of face cream does your partner use? And we jokingly said, we don't know, because if you're married, you probably don't know what cream your partner uses. So I was just calling to sort of share my story. And then I think as an immigrant, a lot of us actually study American history. I became a U.S. citizen in 2000, and it just reminded me, you know, the values that this country is based on and just the beauty of the sense of liberty that America has that makes it so unique. And, of course, that's the reason why I'm running for Senate here in Manchester for this November.
Okay, great. Carla, thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. Let's put that to Abdi, because it seems like Carla says that she has some sense of a greater appreciation for what America stands for and its history. Is that a sentiment that you share?
It is. I share the same feeling that for the immigrants. It's I'm really so much interested in the U.S. history, and I learn things. And even though I still am struggling to the party problems going on in this country and all of that. But
a lot of us struggle with that.
Right. But I find it, what America, what makes this country really wonderful is the image that America has in the face of Earth. You know, like for those of us who are not here, we see America as a very special place, a place that everyone can dream to come, and then you can, if you work hard for it, you can make your dream come true. It's open its doors to the rest of the world. And, you know, for some people like Carla, I think, you know, she was prepared for it. I feel like we have that sort of connection where it's like, I taught myself English. And so in that case, one thing ready, you know, I'm prepared to adjust to the United States when I come here. But then when I arrived, I realized how much I can learn from the U.S. And appreciate the values and the things that we have every day, the privilege that we have. Driving a car from Maine to Concord, New Hampshire, to me was just a privilege. You know, I just smile randomly and I'm like, you know, I never expected that I would do this in my own country. And also the freedom that I have. Like, I could not go to a mosque in Kenya. I could not go to a mosque in Somalia, even though Somalia is my own country. So what happens? The U.S. has provided me this opportunity where, like, I can do anything. I can go exercise my faith and nobody's going to say anything.
Well, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about your life in Maine, what you did when you arrived here, and what life is like for you now. And listeners, if you have questions for Abdi, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Abdi Noor Iptin is the author of the new memoir, Call Me American. Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Share your immigration story if you've got one. Also email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with Abdi Nor Iftin, the author of the new memoir, Call Me American. He's telling us about his life in the United States after having won the Diversity Visa Lottery, the Green Card Lottery. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Abdi, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is how much interaction you had with a few Americans while you were in Somalia who sort of helped you on your way. One of them was our very own Corey Princell here at NHPR, who at the time she was working at The Story, which was a program produced out of WUNC Chapel Hill. She was one of the many, a handful of journalists, I should say, who spoke with you there and also connected with you in with an American who's named Sharon McDonald, who, when you finally came to the United States, she put you up. You were staying with her in Maine. Tell us about your arrival in the United States with Sharon.
Oh, it was amazing. It was beautiful. So they picked me up from Boston the day after Michael Brown was killed. So this was August 11. And she was talking a little bit about that and trying to make sure that I don't have to worry, that, you know, I would be fine with them. To be honest with you, while we drove for 2 hours from Boston to Yarmouth, Maine, you know, the place where they lived, and we had this conversation, it was just one-sided conversation, while Sharon said, you know, we're in this crazy time and we will make sure nothing happens to you. We're going to take you to the neighbors and we will do this, we will do that.
Take you to the neighbors so that they get familiarized with you so
that the neighbors don't call 911 on me
and say, who is this guy walking around the neighborhood?
Who's this guy walking around?
Because Yarmouth is just a small town near Portland, Maine.
Yeah, I think 8,000 people, mm-hmm. and predominantly white. It's hard to see someone of color on the street. So somehow this family, Sharon McDonald and her daughter Natalia and her husband Gib, they were, you know, they kind of took me into their house at a time that was crazy. You know, it was what's going to happen. They were not quite sure what I would be turning into myself. And to me, when she had that conversation with me, I really wasn't sure what she was talking about, mm-hmm. because I was paying so much attention to America at the time. It smelled different. You know, it just felt completely different sitting in the back of this car and with the belt, you know, the seat belt on, and that's what I was paying attention to. And I'm like, you know, we turn into this gas station. I'm like, how does this work? So I started asking so many questions, but Yarmouth had actually become both kind of scary place for me, but also an exciting place.
Why scary?
Well, scary because it kind of feels like the Walking Dead movie places. Mm. You know, like I woke up the first day because I came at night. I woke up the first day and I looked through the window and there's deer grazing peacefully and there's some turkeys and then the horse. They have horses and they have huge land. And then there's the river in the back of the house. So it's kind of this feeling where like, wow, you know, where's the country? Where is the life? Where are the cars? Where are the people? Where are the tall buildings? Like, what's happening here? You know, that's the scary part of it where like I expected I would be ending up in one of the skyscrapers in New York, and I did not know much about Maine. And to me, Yarmouth somehow did not represent what America looked like in my imagination. So that was a completely new introduction into my life, where, you know, I had to get adjusted to this. And going to the neighbors on that same day, where they say, "Oh, his name is Abdi, and he has been through a lot, and we're, you know, taking him in until he finds a job and finds his way out. So if you find him walking on the streets, maybe biking or maybe walking, please don't call 911. He's with us."
Yeah.
So that was the part where I really got scared, because I knew 911 from the movies. And what happens is these, you know, flashy cars show up and the cops arrest people. So that's the part of me where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is not what I really thought of. But they took me in their wings and they said, "Don't worry, nothing is going to happen to you. You're fine." Mm-hmm. So I didn't walk by myself most of the days. I walked with Natalia. So it's, you know, Natalia's, you know, just became like my sister. We would go to Dunkin' Donuts. And it was good, though, that I could go to Dunkin' Donuts, because the cops showed up at the Dunkin' Donuts And then they met me, because if this is a small town, you know, somehow we had to get to know each other. And I was the one who actually started, and I said, hello, hi. And then they realized that I had an accent, and we had a quick conversation, and somehow they figured out, well, you know, let, right there, it's a new guy. And they would see me walking up and down the streets. So that was a very good introduction to me. I was like, I've never, you know, got into trouble, because quickly I was able to get the neighbors and the community and the cops, everybody else got to know me, that I was the guy from Africa and living in this town.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Carol in Holderness. Carol, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just want to thank you and your guest, because I think we who've been here all our lives tend to take for granted the freedoms that we have in the United States. My husband is from Taiwan, and his whole family is from Taiwan and China, and they are so much more appreciative of this country than those of us whose ancestors came a long time ago. And I can't wait to read his book. I'm just really looking forward to it.
Well, thanks, Carol. Appreciate your phone call. Yeah, Adi, I mean, you've been here a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. Are there any moments where you are just so amazed or impressed by a part of American culture that the Americans around you who are sort of used to it say, yeah, no big deal? Are there moments like that for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, first, I want to tell you that I have love for Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to see. I live in Maine, which actually kind of has a growing immigration community. So in the evenings when it's warmer, we play soccer, and, you know, it's like 45, 50 people from all over the world, most of them from Africa and Middle East. And even though I have never met them anywhere else in the world, but America had introduced me to these people from Morocco, from Nigeria, from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Iran. I never thought I would meet them at this point. And then, so I love the part where I play soccer with this absolutely amazing diversity, you know, and then I go home and have apple pie or hamburgers or steak, you know, this typical American food. And then on the weekends, I go and hang out with my friends, and then we go to Somali restaurants and stuff like that, and we have a traditional goat meat or, you know, stuff that, you know, we eat in our country. So America is you know, this is something that I was really surprised. Even though I realize sometimes it's hard for people to hang out or to get together, but at some point, to me, I'm like, I feel like I can be anybody. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like I can live in this white family's house, and they gave me an introduction to how everything works, you know, including how the dishwasher works. And it was easy for me to pick up and learn. And you know, on Christmas time, start rubbing gifts. And then I have my Somali friends who have been here for a long time, and that I found myself being able to teach them, introduce to them. It's like, oh, it's great. You know, you can buy gifts from Amazon and then wrap it up and give it to your friends. That's really amazing. Let's do it. So I find myself really doing this part of a thing where, like, I realize I had been an American even way before I came here at some point.
Do you miss home?
I do miss home. I specifically miss my family, because I'm the only member of my entire family in the United States, 10,000 miles away from them. And so I miss the talking to my mother and kind of physically feeling that she was there. I miss the streets of Mogadishu, but I don't think I want to go back now.
What would you say, As lawmakers consider the value of the diversity lottery program, what would you say the value of it is to people like you, and also to people here in America?
So diversity lottery has allowed wonderful, great immigrants, not only from war-torn countries, but also from the United Kingdom or Canada. You know, one of those advanced nations that if you try to look at it, there's like the caller Carla, or other people who are engineers and doctors in their own countries, but somehow want to come to the United States and this make kind of live in the U.S. It's ridiculous that the White House is this administration is now trying to to stop this system. It's not, you don't have to look at it as the guy who ran over people in his truck in New York, who was from one of the Asian countries, I think. You have to look at the majority and the wonderful people that came to this country through the diversity lottery, and immigrants are doing wonderful in this country, you know. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's my iconic person, himself is an immigrant, but he has done great in this country and became a governor. And if you look at some of the founders of Google, Amazon, those, you can find, you know, immigrants that had really done a great job. So I think it's against the American value, or, you know, the way the people see America, if you just try to close doors to the rest of the world.
Well, Abdi, I wish we had another full hour to continue to chat with you about this, but I want to thank you very much for coming in today and sharing your story and your insights with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That's Abdi Noor Iftin. He's the author of the new memoir, Call Me American. And while we can't continue this conversation on the air right now, the conversation does continue online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and our intern is Abby Sleeper. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.